Today, we'll look at life in rural Iowa from two very different perspectives. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Charity Nebbe. Photographer Danny Wilcox-Frazier has studied rural Iowa through the lens of his camera. He shares what he found in the new documentary, Driftless.
You can do everything here in a small town that you can do in a big city. That is a fat lie. You can't.
I'll talk with him about the film and about his experiences. Then later on, Carol Bodensteiner has written about life in rural Iowa through the lens of memory. Her memoir is Growing Up Country, Memories of an Iowa Farm Girl. She'll share some of those memories of growing up on a dairy farm in the 1950s. We'd also love to hear from you as well with your experiences of life in rural Iowa then and now. Please join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Carol Bodensteiner about her memoir of growing up on an Iowa dairy farm in the 1950s. But first, we'll take a look at rural life in Iowa in the present. Photographer Danny Wilcox-Frazier has studied rural Iowa through the lens of his camera. He shares what he found in the documentary Driftless, Stories from Iowa, a follow-up to his book of still photos. In the documentary, we go from the family farm to the town bar. We meet some of the newest residents of rural Iowa. And in the first part of the film, we visit a family farm with an uncertain future and meet one of the sons.
It's something each generation strives to improve. To let a farm go that my grandparents have struggled to build and my parents have struggled to build, it just don't seem right. I'm not ready for it now, but if it would come to the point where we'd either let it go or I would keep going, I'd probably try to keep it going.
Danny Wilcox-Frazier is here with me now. Of course, that was a moment from his film, Driftless. And Danny, you first went out and you took still photos of rural Iowa. Then you followed up with a video camera. What were you looking for when you set out?
Well, I think the book of stills is my statement. It's my experience and really, I didn't have anything else to say myself, but what I thought I could do with the documentary was allow my subjects to tell their story in their own voice. And, you know, I think that the soundbite you just played, you know, Kevin speaking about, you know, whether he truly was ready to commit his entire working life, you know, to agriculture was one of the moments I was looking for. You know, this is a kid who's been working on the farm his entire life. You know, there's one photo in the book where Kevin is sleeping in, and it was still early. I had just gotten there, and his mother, you know, I asked where Kevin was, and his mom said he's sleeping, and I couldn't believe it because he was always, you know, first up out with the dairy cows. And so, you know, she took me up to his room, and we snuck in real quiet, and I made a photograph of him sleeping. But, you know, this is a kid who'd been working from typically before sunrise every single day, 7 days a week. And, you know, there still was that connection to the family farm, a farm that had been handed down through his mother's side for generations that, you know, even though he was questioning whether he wanted to work that hard for the rest of his life, you know, there's still that connection that he felt that he couldn't let it go, that he would take it over at such a young age.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in LeClaire, Iowa, a small town north of the Quad Cities, blue-collar town, you know, river town.
And you have chosen to live in Iowa, but in this film, you don't paint a particularly beautiful picture of the state. What were you hoping to accomplish in showing a very dark side of this state?
Well, I think a part of that comes from my own, you know, the conflict within me about, you know, staying in Iowa. No different than a lot of kids who grow up in these small towns. You know, all I ever thought about as a young person was escape, escaping that small town, not becoming trapped and entombed in it. You know, fortunately, I was able to move away for college, came a whole hour west, jumped on I-80 and ended up here at the university. But, you know, once I was done with my undergrad studies, I was able to move out of the country, lived in Nairobi, Kenya for a year and did end up back in Iowa. And I think I, you know, still was grappling with that, you know, unease of my own childhood, how I felt about growing up in rural Iowa. So that tension plays out. But at the same time, I find a lot of beauty in the, in the landscape once all the corn is down. Yeah, you know, color photos of this, you know, of a green sea of corn or soybeans, you know, during the summer is beautiful to look at, great postcards. But for me, you know, just how rough of a place Iowa can be, I think it's more revealed in the landscape once harvest is over. And I find beauty in the fact that, you know, life has its ups and downs, and I don't try to focus on any one point more than the other, meaning not the high points or the low points too much. I try to just ride that roller coaster with my work.
You talk about how beautiful color pictures of Iowa are in the summer, but you all of your pictures in this book and in the documentary are in black and white. Why did you choose black and white?
Because I started photographing this project in both color and black and white, and often the color photographs just spoke to the color of the scene, of the situation, and I felt black and white allowed me to get into the emotion of my subjects, and then again, you know, my own feeling about growing up here and living here, and so I actually felt that the black and white was more honest. It's not how we see, or how the vast majority of us see, but, you know, it to me felt more honest.
You start the film on this family farm with an uncertain future. It's struggling financially, and the boys are working hard, and Kevin is trying to decide what he wants for his future, and his parents are hoping that he will continue the family farm. Then you move to the town bar. Why did you want us to see what was going on in a small town bar?
Well, because I spend a lot of time in those bars. used to. Two young children, no time for that now. But it growing up, I remember, you know, my grandfather always being at his local bar and in Princeton, Iowa, and you know, my dad and I would sometimes stop by and, you know, my grandfather would be playing cards in a back room and he'd come out and stuff a $20 bill and, you know, in my shirt pocket. And, you know, so there was always this kind of, you know, romanticized, like, memory of small town bars. But, you know, I wanted to look at, you know, what are these places? Why do people spend so much time? And I think a lot of it is, there's just, when you look at agriculture, there are times of the year where there's a lot of downtime. This is a place to socialize, so it brings people together. That's a very positive thing within a community. But then you throw, you know, excessive consumption of alcohol, which of course isn't the majority of people, but, you throw that into the mix and you have a recipe for some, you know, difficult times for people. And I was looking at some of, you know, the social side of it, but also the difficult, you know, people looking to escape, you know, their reality and, meaning with the subject in the documentary tomorrow, she, you know, was escaping that feeling of being trapped in a small town. Fortunately, she was able to do what she needed to do, which was move to Denver and to move away from her small town.
Well, and she says some very bitter, angry things about life in a small town. One of the things she says was the only three things that there are to do in Iowa are drink, do drugs, and have sex. So, so that paints a really stark picture of her existence.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And, that was very difficult when we were working on that chapter. The production company in New York I worked with, I was going back and forth between Iowa City and New York during the editing process. And it you know, it was how much of that do we put forward? Because, you know, we can pick these little tiny moments, just actually pieces of a person's life, and just focus in so tightly on it that we think that is their, you know, that summarizes their entire lifetime. And you know, this is someone who, you know, went through a difficult period, and she was able to move beyond it and is doing incredibly well in school. She's getting married. I'm going to be going out to Colorado and photographing her wedding. I mean, you know, this is just a little tiny piece. So, you know, as a photographer, filmmaker, you have to really be conscious of focusing in on those little tiny pieces, and, you know, making sure that doesn't, like, define this person in total.
Well, you profile her, and then you move on, and you profile some teenagers, or you spend some time with some teenagers who are playing on the river and drinking a lot and talking about drugs and talking about how, you know, they want to get out and get away. They could be teenagers anywhere. I mean, teenagers, I've rarely have had a conversation with a teenager where they said, I absolutely love where I live. I love everything about it. This is where I want to make my life. Teenagers go through this period of searching and being unhappy with where they are and sometimes who they are. What makes this an Iowa story?
Well, a lot of the young people I was dealing with at Jumping Rock, for those in the Iowa City area who know, this is, you know, cliffs that people, it's illegal to jump off the cliffs. It's illegal to be drinking there, but it's a place, you know.
But it's done.
It's done. you know, there are a lot of teenagers and then young adults, people in their early 20s, and most of the people I concentrated on were in that age category. And for me, the reason why I was there is because of kind of the reckless abandon that a lot of those people felt. You know, I just felt like it was important to tell the story of those who either couldn't make it out through education, meaning, you know, they weren't able to make it onto college, or those, you know, and that comes through economics or just their ability within school. So, you know, I really wanted to concentrate on that population, those who are, you know, left in the wake of out-migration, because a lot of what this is about is the difficulties that these communities are facing due to depopulation. It's happening all across the state of Iowa. Last census, you know, nearly half of Iowa's 99 counties, you know, lost population. And you know, we'll see what those numbers come to now. You know, that's what I was really trying to you know, get there. But
well, we'll talk more about these stories and more about some of the newest residents of the state of Iowa. You profile them as well. Danny Wilcox Frazier is my guest. His documentary is called Driftless. You can find a link to the documentary on our Facebook page. Search for Iowa Public Radio. You can also find that on our Twitter feed as well, at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and coming up in about 10 minutes, we're going to be taking a look at the past of rural life in Iowa. We'll talk with Carol Bodensteiner, who's written a memoir about growing up on an Iowa dairy farm in the 1950s. Right now, we're talking about present rural life in Iowa with photographer Danny Wilcox Frazier. He has put together the new documentary, Driftless, Stories from Iowa. It's a follow-up to his book of still photos by the same title, Driftless. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your thoughts as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, at IPR Talk on Twitter. And you can also send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we did get a tweet about this subject, and I want to know what your reaction is, because I mentioned it before, but when you watch this documentary, it doesn't paint a very pretty picture of rural life in Iowa. And one of the people who tweeted about it said that Driftless is an engaging art piece, but the perception it breeds is toxic. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I completely understand where people are coming from. There's this just romanticized view of Midwestern life. And I think it's, you know, for a lot of people, it is accurate. just not for everyone. And you know, I'm one of those people that feels that it's a, you know, it's a very difficult life. And present day economics, when you look at you know, the economics of rural Iowa, meaning agriculture that is directly connected, if you want to look at it as far as profitability to scale. You know, I'm looking at the family farmer. I'm looking at the individual, the Harry Phelps of rural Iowa, and you know, the difficulties that they have been having for years. You know, a lot of where this comes from, as far as, you know, my personal perspective is, you know, the farm crisis. I came of age during the farm crisis, so the Quad Cities area where I grew up lost 30,000 manufacturing jobs during the farm crisis. And, you know, it affected us on a very personal level, but obviously as a community, it was devastating. Most of the people who lived in LeClaire, my hometown, you know, worked for John Deere, IH, Case, and Cat, and you know, it just was a very difficult time. So I'm not saying that this is all of rural Iowa. I'm just saying that this is a segment. And you know, you look at a country butcher, someone who, you know, can't rely on a steady income. You know, it's whatever, how many ever head they're going to be that week, that's what he's going to make. You know, working, you know, a couple other jobs. So people who are working 2-3 jobs, you know, I'm just trying to, it might be the minority of people living within, you know, rural Iowa, but it's a segment that I feel, you know, needs to have their story told. And it's also how I feel. So if you disagree with me, then, you know, I you know, please go tell your story.
Anne is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Anne.
Hi. When I was 12, we moved out to a farm, parts of it I absolutely, you know, love doing some things and that. But this state, I was born here, lived in Cedar Rapids, which I do not like. I have always felt stuck here. So this show was like, oh, good, somebody else feels that way too. But I have always ended up staying here or getting drawn back here. But if I had to live any place, I'd be in Paris. And I try to go there as often as I can, but I'm still here on the farm. But I get out as often as I can because I can't stand it here.
What do you want people to know, Anna? We were talking about this sort of idyllic idea that a lot of people have of rural life. What would you want people to know about the reality of your life that you don't think people do know?
Well, it's 24/7, especially when you have animals, and which I don't anymore. But if you have animals that you have to get up and care for, it doesn't matter whether there's a blizzard and it's 30 below outside, 80 wind chill factor, you know. You have to go out there. You have to take care of them. If they're sick, you have to be out there and do it. If something's sick and you're planning to go somewhere, you have to stay there. You just can't leave. And it's harder to find somebody to babysit your farm than it is your children. I mean, you can find the babysitters all the time for your kids, but for your livestock, no. So you have to get up at 4:30 every day. You may be out in the fields until midnight and come back in. It's constant work, work, work. And thank God if you do have people that you get along with that you work with. I know some people that did this and they never got along with their spouses, their kids, anything. Thank God I didn't have that. Otherwise there would be, I mean, it's constant work.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for calling and sharing your perspective today. Danny, you know, a lot of the pictures that you show us are of these small towns, and I think all of us have been to small towns in Iowa where the town that I was born into, driving down Main Street has certainly brought tears to my eyes more than once because, again, it was a town that was really hard hit by the farm crisis, and there are lots of boarded up windows and the Maid Rite is closed and, you know, it is really not a thriving community. But you also show how communities that have embraced recent migrants are some communities that do seem to have a future. What did you want people to see with that segment?
Yeah, you know, a lot of us who've traveled to places like, you know, West Liberty or, you know, Conesville, you know, we see, you know, communities that are growing and you know, some of these towns that, yes, they're usually centered around, say, a Tyson meatpacking plant or something like that. But, you know, they're seeing an increase in population. But more importantly, in West Liberty, you know, you're looking at a vibrant, you know, viable downtown, a lot of small businesses, you know, that are family owned that are doing really well. And, you know, that for me is the bright spot within rural Iowa, communities that have, you know, embraced, you know, Hispanic immigration or Hispanic increase in population. You know, West Liberty, I believe, was the first school district in the state to have a dual language program. And, you know, these are, you know, things that can help a community grow and redefine itself. And, you know, that is the hope for rural Iowa. You know, it's difficult with immigration because it's become such a politicized topic. And, you know, in my opinion, it's been used to divide the electorate. And you know, we've kind of lost sight of, you know, what we should be looking at.
When people watch your film or look at the photographs and read about your experiences in your book, what do you hope they take away from it?
I hope that they care about rural America. You know, last presidential cycle, which was historic, I was fortunate enough to cover from the caucuses all the way to the inauguration. You know, every candidate was speaking about initiatives that would help, you know, rural America, not just rural Iowa. This is a problem across the nation. You know, financial incentives that would make it possible for small businesses to do well, to prosper in rural America. And then it seems like once they leave Iowa, you know, maybe they bring it up if they're in another rural state, but it's over. You know, we have a Secretary of Agriculture, you know, from right here in Iowa, and you know, is working and pushing. But I feel we need these stories more in, you know, the spotlight, in the national spotlight. My piece isn't, you know, about specifics. It's more of an overall view of what life is like. You know, it's a feeling, it's an emotion, you know, and hopefully then smaller, you know, tighter stories will be done about the specifics. And you know, that's what I hope comes of it.
What's the next story you want to tell?
I'm working on a new book called Lost Nation, which looks at a lot of very similar communities. During the presidential campaign, I felt that you know, well, one of the issues that really caught my attention was wealth consolidation. I just feel like there's a segment of the American population that just is not part of our political or national dialogue. And you know, I've been traveling to, you know, very, you know, historic impoverished areas, the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, Appalachia, Detroit, you know, communities in the Deep South and Southwest along the border region. And you know, working on bringing light to, you know, these places that reside in the shadows.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Danny Wilcox Frazier is a photographer, and he has produced the new documentary, Driftless, Stories from Iowa. You can find a link to the documentary on our Facebook page. Go to Facebook and search for Iowa Public Radio, or you can also find it on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and now we're going to take a very different look at Life in Rural Iowa. With me now is Carol Bodensteiner, and she has written a memoir about growing up on a dairy farm in the 1950s. It's called Growing Up Country, Memories of an Iowa Farm Girl. Carol, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. I'm happy to be here.
Tell me where your farm was.
Our farm was in Jackson County. That's eastern Iowa, as far east as you can go. We were about halfway between Dubuque and Davenport.
And
we had a dairy farm in the hills of eastern Iowa.
All right. And how many cows did you have?
At the peak, we had 50 cows that were the milking herd. We probably had 75 total by the time you counted calves and cows that were dried off.
You were one of three girls in your family?
Yes, there were three of us. I was the middle one. My older sister, Jane, was 2 years older, and my younger sister, Sue, was 2 years younger.
There's a wonderful part in your book where you write about turning 10 years old. What happened when you were 10?
Well, 10 was a very important age for us because on our farm, as in many farms, you worked from the very earliest age. You did small chores. You might bed the calf pens or get the eggs from the chickens. But when you turned 10 on our farm, you were more or less considered an adult. And so you came into doing much more important things. And one of the thing that really signified turning 10 on our farm was that you got to carry milk. And when people hear me say that, I got to carry milk. This was a real prize for me, not I had to carry milk, but I got to, because I got to work then alongside my parents in a really significant, important way.
And it was a real rite of passage for you.
It was a rite of passage. You were no longer considered just a little kid doing little things. You were pretty much considered an adult because it's an odd thing. When I look at kids who are 10 years old today, I really look at them and say, is that possible that we could carry milk? Because these were 5-gallon pails of milk. And I guess that my dad figured that we were either old enough or tall enough or strong enough or smart enough to figure out how to lift those pails and get them poured into the strainer on the bulk tank. But
it wasn't easy. How did you have to do it?
It was not easy, and I looked to my older sister for guidance because she'd been carrying milk for 2 years by the time I got into that position. And, you know, you learn to lift it with one hand, balance it on your knee as you were trying to get this, your other hand underneath it, and then hoist it up so that it would rest on the edge of the strainer as you poured it in. And then you had to be careful because the strainer would tip because it wasn't secure in there. It was just sitting in there, you know, so you had to pour it a little bit so you didn't pour too much and run it over, and also not rest it too hard so that it tipped the strainer and splashed the milk out.
You write a lot about your chores and the work that you did alongside your parents on the farm. And now I don't know if it's the lens of memory or if it really was that way, but it was something that you really seemed to love getting to be a part of.
I did love getting to be a part of it, and I think about this a lot because it does seem odd. You would have to agree. It does seem odd that I would enjoy the work so much, but I did, and I do think it was my parents' approach to it that made it that way. They engaged us from pre-memory in doing work. And I know this is true because my mom took pictures of everything. And one of the pictures that she took was of me helping my dad plant potatoes. And if you've planted potatoes, or anyone listening has planted potatoes, you know, it's a stick the shovel in the ground, open up the slot, put a seed potato down in. And in this picture, I am standing next to my dad with my little bucket of seed potatoes. And I am probably 2 years old. And I know, thinking on it, that I was probably more troubled than I was worth at 2 years old to helping my dad plant potatoes. But that was their approach. We were involved in everything. We were welcomed in everything. And I believe that kids up to a certain point really want to be with their parents. And So we wanted to be there. And because what they were doing was clearly important, when we were able to be involved in that too, we became important. And I think it spills over to my attitude about work today, that I feel best, I feel most fulfilled when I'm actually doing physical things, when I'm working in the garden, when I'm canning vegetables, when I'm doing any of those things that I did when I was growing up on the farm. I feel valuable.
Well, and you write in the epilogue of the book that your sister said, you know, it's been an awfully long time if you're feeling nostalgic about milking cows.
Yeah.
but you well, do. You seem to remember it awfully fondly.
I do remember it fondly. And I liked the cows. It's been so interesting to hear from people who have read my book, and I will remember and cherish the letter that I received from one woman who had grown up on a farm, on a dairy farm, and she said that she just wanted off. She wanted nothing to do with those cows for the rest of her life. And so when she was old enough, she got away from the farm. And what do you know? She fell in love with and married a guy who was a dairy farmer. and she says, she concluded her letter, "And we've had a good life with the cows."
We'll talk more about your memories of growing up on the farm in just a moment. My guest is Carol Bodensteiner. Her memoir is Growing Up Country, Memories of an Iowa Farm Girl. And we'd love to hear your memories as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest now is Carol Bodensteiner. She's written about her very happy childhood growing up on a dairy farm in the 1950s. It's called Growing Up Country, Memories of an Iowa Farm Girl. And if you experience this kind of rural life, give us a call and share some of your memories. 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Carol, when you were growing up, did you think that you wanted to continue that kind of a life, to live on a farm?
Well, I know that when I was growing up, going to college was always an expectation and an understanding that we would go to college. And when I think about the options that were in front of women at that time, rural women in Iowa, they were fairly limited, and they were limited to what we saw those members of our family doing. So teaching was very high on the list of career options for me. Of course, being a housewife, but being a teacher, being a nurse. My older sister became a nurse. That was not going to be me. And I remember when my sisters and I were playing, we would play school on the steps of our house. And so, you know, you would just earn the right to advance a grade by choosing the right hand or something. And so teaching was one of those things that I intended to do. And so going off to college, I had the opportunity to come back on the farm after I had married. And my first husband, he was not a farmer, and, you know, we were on a different track. Now, nostalgia plays in. I would love to have that farm now, but I think one of the things that I do remember in retrospect, of course, is how much work it is. And when you're farming, you're not really doing anything else. You're farming. And it takes every minute and every bit of energy. So, you know, nostalgia does play a part, I know.
What made you sit down and start writing out these memories of yours?
My mother. my mom was always after me to write the stories of our family. She said, "You're a writer. You can write, you know." And, you know, we want to do what our moms want us to do, you know. At some level, we always want to please our moms. And, you know, so when I started writing, I really started writing about my parents. I was going to write their stories. And the more I talked with them about the jobs that Dad had during the Depression, or Mom teaching in country school, or, you know, when they were first on the farm, the more I talked with them, the more I remembered my own stories. And the feedback that I got from my writing instructors was, what you're writing about yourself is more interesting than what you're writing about your parents. So, you know, they really encouraged me along that line, and so did my mom. So memory is like that, you know. When you start remembering something, then that kind of triggers some other memory, and you just continue to remember, and it brings up more and more. So my mom got me started, and I have continued.
One of the stories that you tell in the very beginning of the book, I just loved because it reminded me so much of the farm women that I knew growing up. But it's about country hospitality and serving lunch for people. Tell us about lunch on the farm.
Well, my mom she just enjoyed serving food and having people sit at the table. But lunch was one of those things that is typical of farm life, you know. So if someone comes to your house, they're pretty much going to eat something, and it wouldn't matter if it was midday or mid-afternoon or evening, you're going to have lunch. And it was from mom's perspective, it was going to be what any of us today would consider pretty much a complete meal, because even if it was sandwiches, there would also be fruit, there would be pickles of some sort, there would be something that you would consider dessert, you know. She put out food like nobody's business. But I found that to be true, that country hospitality, no matter where we went, if we were at somebody else's place, you were going to sit down and have coffee and cookies. You were going to eat. It was it was what you did. But on a dairy farm, it was also sort of a signal that If you were having lunch in the afternoon, lunch was on the table, and then it was time for you to leave if you were a guest, because, you know, we had to go out and do chores. If lunch was served later in the evening, it was kind of a signal, time for you to leave now because we're going to bed. So lunch was just an integral part of the hospitality of farm life, very important.
You also write about that hospitality went two ways. It was a two-way street, and you write about a time when you were a young girl and you learned a very hard lesson about accepting people's hospitality with some hot cocoa. What happened?
Yeah, the hot cocoa. We went to a neighbor's house, a very wonderful woman and her husband on a neighboring farm, and my dad rented farm hay ground from them. She offered to serve us kids hot cocoa, and as it turns out, she didn't have any milk. Theirs was not a dairy farm. She didn't have any milk, and so she made the hot cocoa with hot water and just cocoa.
Just cocoa
baking
powder.
Cocoa, not sweetened quick or anything like that, but it turned out to be horrible. And the thing that I learned about hospitality at that point was that if people serve it, you eat it and you are thankful for it. And you don't, it's part of the hospitality to serve it, but it's also part of the hospitality to appreciate it and to eat it.
Even if it's not good.
Even if it's not good. this was so definitely not good. I think it is one of the things that turned me off on coffee for many years is the idea of that hot chocolate lingered in my mind.
Patrick is on the line from Des Moines at 866-780-9100. Hello, Patrick.
Good morning.
Do you have a memory you'd like to share?
Yes. My memory would be of going to Dubuque County, not far from Jackson County, rural Bernard, Iowa, in the 1950s, probably 1952, to share a task with my cousin, also named Pat, and the two of us would have ponies, and as many as 8 or 10 farmers would come with their teams of horses, and they did a task one farm after another for a couple of weeks. You know, Monday they'd do one farm, Tuesday another farm. And that task was called thrashing. And thrashing involved the farmers going around and collecting big pieces of, you know, reams of straw and oats. And they'd carry the straw and oats to a central point on the farm where the thrashing machine was, and it would shake up those straw and oats, and what came out at the other end were bales of straw and very nice, you know, buckets of oats. The buckets were obviously big piles of oats that would then be moved to the farm barn. And my cousin Pat and I would ride on two little ponies, and we would have nice cold water for the 8 or 10 farmers who were doing the work. And we'd ride around on our two ponies, and they'd have a drink of water. And then at noontime, there'd be a big lunch served at the farmhouse. And that kind of a lunch was immortalized by Grant Wood in a painting. I can't say that he painted our lunch, because the painting was done 20 years earlier, but you can see the farmers all washing their faces at a pump and sitting down, and people scurrying around serving lunch at noon. And when I see that Grant Wood painting, I think about thrashing on the Curo farm in Bernard, Iowa in the 1952 period.
Oh, Patrick, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Sure.
Thanks a lot. Carol, I'm sure you get people's stories all the time, people who want to share similar stories of growing up on farms.
I do, and it has been one of the unexpected pleasures of having written this book, is the opportunity to go around and talk to people, because what I didn't realize is what Pat said, is that, you know, we were all out there on farms having a very similar experience. And I have been so surprised and so humbled to learn that my stories tell stories very similar to the lives of so many other people. And so I really encourage people to collect their everyday stories. It's just so important that these stories not be lost. And, you know, to the point about the thrashing lunch that Patrick brings up, I was at a library event some time ago, and it was a group of women who got to talking about how lunch was served for thrashing. And there was a whole book that could be written about the differences in the way thrashing lunches happened and how meals got served with their families and so on, and how the women on one farm where the thrashers were going to be might share the food that was left over from their meal with the farm wife who was putting on the meal for the next stop for the thrashers, or how the woman who was going to be serving the next day would call the woman before and say, "What did you have?" because she didn't want to serve the same thing. You know, so the commonality of experiences of farm life is quite amazing, and it surprised me to find out how, because I just thought, you know, here I'm growing up on the farm and I must be the only one having these experiences, and come to find out we share a lot of experiences from the farms.
Why do you think these stories resonate with people so much? You said it's important not to lose these stories. Why?
Well, you know, I think that when I talk to people and I ask them, have they written down their stories, or tape recorded them or anything, and many people have thought about it, but they think, oh, what I'm doing is not important, you know, who would care, I just lived an everyday life. And I think that that's what most of us do. Most of us live our everyday lives, just getting those meals on the table, getting the kids to school, taking care of the house, putting in the crops every year. And our everyday lives are important. It's not just the people who discover a cure for cancer or who climb Mount Everest. Our everyday lives are important because they are the fabric of what keeps this country together. And so I really encourage people to figure out a way to collect their stories. And, you know, one of the things that people do when they start to remember the stories is they start talking about them. And that then creates connections within a family. If that story never went anywhere except around the dinner table and people said, oh, yeah, I remember, or I don't remember that, you know, but here's what I remember. And then, you know, they're really solidifying the story of just one family, but that's very important.
In the first part of the program today, we were talking about how this kind of way of life has been lost in many ways. Do you feel that?
I think that many things have changed. Many things have changed. Just the ability to be in contact with people via the computer or the phone in a real-time basis allows you to spread out your contact way beyond the family, just the family unit that we had on the farm. You know, we had a phone on our farm, of course. We had a phone on our farm, but you only used it pretty much if there was an emergency. And after 9 o'clock at night, you didn't use it at all. That was just the rule in our house. Computers make it easy to get out. Television is quite different now than it was in the 1950s. You know, we had families that looked like our family on TV in the 1950s. We didn't have diversity that we were seeing on a regular basis. TV was off the air at 11 o'clock at night. You know, there wasn't 24/7 news. It's quite different. And farming has changed because of the advent of large equipment allowing farmers to farm more acres. I think the things that are the same, and this has surprised me too, because I don't know. I had no expectations, but I didn't expect the generational interest in these stories, because I've heard from women in their 90s who grew up on farms and remember 4-H demonstrations that they did when they were in 4-H. But I've also heard from 20-somethings who grew up on farms. And what is the same is the connection with the land, the connection with the animals, and the connection with the family. It's different, but it's still so strong on farms. And that is, I'm so pleased to hear that farm kids are getting that out of their growing up country experiences as I did when I was growing up. It's the same, but it's different. Does that make any sense?
I think so. The world is a different place. But when, again, through the first part of the program, we were talking about some of the downsides of growing up in rural Iowa, some of the isolation and feelings of longing that people can experience. But you're talking about and writing about how that isolation, living in that kind of a bubble, can also be such a wonderful experience.
It can be a wonderful experience. I went to a one-room country school for 8 years. I was, in fact, the only one in my class for 7 of 8 years. There's a downside to that from a socialization standpoint and having close friends and people that you're doing things with. I was close with people across a wide range of ages, but also I got one-on-one education. I got, my teacher and I were one-to-one for 7 years. and so my very strong educational foundation came from an experience that some people would say, well, what didn't you get? You didn't get art. You didn't get, you know, lots of experience with music. You didn't. But what I got was so strong that I have a hard time saying in any way that was not a good experience. It was very positive.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for sharing your stories today.
Charity, I am delighted. I want to say that I'm going to be speaking at the West Des Moines Public Library on November 4th at 7 o'clock and also at the Mason City Public Library on Saturday, November 6th.
All right. Thanks a lot, Carol. Carol Bodensteiner is the author of Growing Up Country, Memories of an Iowa Farm Girl. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News.